I can enjoy it.
When I got home from school yesterday, I found my mother lying face down in our backyard. Her arms lay flat at her sides, palms skyward. I watched her from the window over the kitchen sink and was distracted by a cardinal in the willow by the back fence. I reached in the junk drawer for a small mirror and walked quietly out the door to the yard. I got as far as Mom's pink and lime-squared quilt when the bird flew off to the north. My eyes followed its flight, and when it was gone, I turned to her. There'd been no movement, no sound. I knelt by her head and placed the compact mirror beneath her nose. It fogged. I nodded and went back indoors. She nearly had me worried. It was Thursday, an Indian summer, October afternoon. I started in on some dirty dishes in the sink. Maybe the wind shifted back toward the house because I suddenly heard a very faint, shallow snoring sound that I knew as well as her sneeze or her coughing pattern, one long wheezing cough followed by three short hacks, International Morse code for the letter B. I think I would remember her laugh if I heard it. I'm not any kind of a fanatic for cleanliness, but I don't like for my brother Jeff to come home and see half-empty bottles of cooking sherry lying around when nobody's been doing any cooking for days. So I cleared the counter of its detritus, the saucer with its melted, hacked-at butter brick, an island in congealed saffron, the errant salt and pepper shakers, nowhere near each other, needing a reintroduction, the hardened half-slices and crumbs of white bread, they get tossed out. So, Jeffy is 10. We share an obsession for all things space-related. I put him on the back of my Peugeot Mobilette last month, and we drove up to Chambly to see Star Wars in English at the Boîte de Film. He liked the Han Solo wisecracks. I liked the part where Luke comes home and finds everything has been destroyed by lasers. But that got me thinking, and I missed the two next scenes. To be fair, I'll tell you, it was our mom who paid for our tickets. It took a long time for me to realize that when I would come home from school and she'd say, "It's a lovely day, why don't you go for a ride?" It was because she was after a stashed wine bottle somewhere in the house and couldn't get at it if I was in the way. It's only lately that Jeffy has been seeing what goes on, too. He was never a problem to her in that way before. The day we went to see Star Wars, she and I were yelling at each other, and I was saying rude things because I found empty beer cans in my closet, and of course they were hers, but I didn't have the guts to say so. I'm a gutless wonder that way. My strong suit in such confrontations is the gorilla attack, you'll see what I mean. Well, she said something like, "That's a fine way to talk to me after I spent all morning rolling coppers so you and your brother could see that space movie." She was right about that, I mean, obviously, but I sure wouldn't admit it then. Instead, I laughed at her for calling pennies coppers. I didn't thank her for the movie, either. Jeffy did. I don't know if she got it, though. It was after 9 when we returned, and that's usually too late in the day to be saying anything important. Just before it was totally black outside, I went to wake her and suggested she go to bed. "Did your brother eat?" she asked, sitting up and squinting, rubbing her bare arms in the dusk with the stitch of a quilt square impressed on her forehead like a lobotomy scar. "Yeah, I made a Kraft pizza," I said. "There's a slice left if you want." She stood uneasily. "I'm not very hungry," she said. "Uh-huh." I gathered up the quilt and followed her in. Jeffy was born in 67 when I was 5. Our dad sold bicycle parts all over eastern Ontario and southern Quebec. We got this love of space from him, now that I think about it. He used to tell me about the Buck Rogers serials he and his brothers saw at the movies in the 30s. I thought he was putting me on with all that Ming the Merciless stuff and the gadgets and all. Our Christmas in 69 seemed to have a space theme. As presents, I mean the real ones, not what you need, Jeffy and I got this foot-long yellow plastic replica of the Apollo 11 rocket and a bag full of little astronauts, made of molded plastic and colored, of course, red, white, or blue. Some carried shovels or cameras or what looked like ray guns, but were probably just Geiger counters or something. Even Dad couldn't say one way or another, so he bluffed that it had to be a special rat ray to defend Neil and Buzz from the hordes of giant space mice that inhabited the moon. He died a few years later on the Trans-Canada, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't his fault. I tell myself that sometimes things just happen. It was a bad night to be driving. They said so on the radio. Mom never felt like I did, though. She screamed at me once when I told Jeffy that things happen, that life goes on. I figure, honestly, try to be an adult about it. Anyway, we didn't have a car after that. When I turned 14, I got my mobilette, which, by the way, is just a moped, but it's one of those words we use in English here. We don't have to wear helmets, but I recently sent away for this cool NASA decal I saw on the back pages of All Out War. As soon as I saw it, I knew it would look wicked on a white helmet with a full face mask and visor. I preferred that to the kind my friend Randy Canello was using. Mrs. Canello insisted he wear a helmet, and he hated it because no one else we know had to. So he was happy to hear I wanted to try his on. He rides a Vespa Chow. Anyway, the helmet has no face guard. And he bought a visor at Canadian Tire that's pretty unique. It doesn't snap on to the helmet like most do. The visor is instead attached to a black plastic brim, and it's the brim that snaps onto the helmet. See? I guess the advantage to this is that you can flip the visor up at will if you want to talk to someone. And also, the visor isn't an inch away from your nose, getting steamed up on the colder days. I think he really just liked the idea of flipping up the visor when we would come to a stoplight, so he could hear you perfectly and look cool as he flipped it up. I gunned the Peugeot, it's a green Hercules, up to 30 miles an hour on Boulevard Saint-Jean, and I was enjoying it too until I lifted my head half an inch too high and the gust of wind blew the visor up and back like it wanted to take off my head. I found myself looking at sky blue above me with my eyes tearing and cars all around. I had to fight the wind to get my head back down, simultaneously easing up on the gas with my right hand. "Thing tried to kill me," I yelled, throwing the helmet at Randy. Boy, did he laugh. "Nimrod, there's a visor lock on the brim." It only convinced me that the full face mask was the way to go. I knew Armstrong and Aldrin wouldn't put up with that nonsense. Not on the surface of the moon, not anywhere. My mom was a secretary at a clinic not far from here, until they let her go for taking too many sick days. She would bring home to me the National Geographic any time they did a story on the lunar landings or the Viking and Mariner Mars probes. Maybe this shows up a difference between Jeffy and me age-wise. On his wall in our bedroom is the Montreal Gazette review of Star Wars and a picture of an Imperial stormtrooper. On mine is the Pierre Mion painting of all the NASA astronauts standing together on the moon. But on our door is a photo of Skylab, and we share that one. We agree on Skylab. Our dad died in the spring of 73. What upset me most when I first heard of the accident was that he was going to miss the launch of the first three astronauts up to the unmanned Skylab. This was even better because it had been damaged in the launch, see, and Conrad and Weitz and Kerwin, they had to fix it or they'd have nowhere to stay. I guess if they failed, they would have to turn around and come home early. That was never clear to me. Skylab was this long cylindrical craft, kind of shaped like an American long-necked beer bottle with a windmill attached to it at one end. The windmill was actually a four-winged solar array beneath which were eight solar telescopes. And that was one reason Skylab was even up there, to get a better look at the sun and solar flares. And also to look back down here at our crops and oil fields and the fish in our oceans. Look, maybe in 1978 that sounds like no big deal, but it was pretty new 5 years ago. The plan was to send up three astronauts to do their tests and then bring them back after a month. Then three others would be sent up, they would do their tests, and they'd be up there for 2 months. The final team of three would go up, and they'd be up there for another 3 months. And my dad thought this was the amazing thing, because no man had ever spent so much time away from the Earth and its gravity before. The thing was, for months after Dad was gone, Jeffy would start crying late at night, and I had a hell of a time getting him to stop. I tried consoling him, and that didn't work, so I tried calling him names, and that didn't do it either. What finally did it, and it took over a year, was a geographic story on the Skylab missions. I woke up to his sobbing one night and showed him the Skylab article. He's a smart kid. And smart kids like to look at blueprints and things like that. We looked at the cutaway drawing of Skylab, which showed where the astronauts slept and worked, and the wardroom where they ate, and there was even a little astronaut in there testing an SMU. A space maneuvering unit. That's a gas-powered jetpack. When I saw that the SMU was nicknamed the Buck Rogers Flying Machine, I told Jeffy to keep looking while I went to the bathroom. Yeah, that would have brought us back to square one, him seeing me cry and me telling him why. The next day, we built our own Skylab out of cardboard packing boxes from our basement. He said what he liked most about Skylab was the idea of having a home in space where no one could come or go without the permission of the head astronaut. And I let Jeffy be the head astronaut, even though I was more qualified, and I had the helmet. But like I say, try to be an adult about it. As for me, the best thing about it was the EVA, the extravehicular activity, or spacewalk. Those first astronauts to reach the deserted orbiting lab had to leave their little craft and fix the solar array that would supply the lab with power, making it livable. Then throughout the missions, they had to leave the relative safety of Skylab and float out to make repairs, like rigging up a makeshift sunscreen of mylar and nylon over the ship to keep the sun from baking them like potatoes. Now, I keep a picture in my wallet. It's one of the astronauts on an EVA. His umbilical tether reaches out from the right foreground like a papier-mâché snake, disappearing in the glare on the camera lens and ending up, I suppose, where he stands. Now, I can't see his face behind the black visor. He holds up both arms, the right higher than the left, in a wave. Now, I used to think this was cute. A tourist shot. But now it only worries me. Why does he put such faith in that white line? How does he know the other astronauts won't tire of him and close the hatch, unwilling at last to make an effort to like him? How do I know for sure that behind that visor wasn't a look of despair? National Geographic tells me he was waving, but they weren't there. Maybe he was crying, his arms raised in a gesture of futility. How more alone do you get than to be floating through the cosmos on a leash? When I left for school this morning, Mom was more or less fine. She was sitting in her robe watching Good Morning America on the 12-inch black and white in the kitchen. When I got back at 3:30, she was asleep on the couch in the basement. I sat in the chair beside her to watch MASH. Halfway through, she woke up, rose, and sort of staggered to the stairs without saying a word. Beats me why I'd do it. I said just loud enough, "Sure, have another." To which she would normally tell me to go to hell or F off. But there was no reply as she made it upstairs. Maybe I wanted to catch her in the act and yell at her, or at least, you know, say something mean, so I padded up the stairs as stealthily as I could. She was at the top of the stairs, her back to me, unaware I was there. She stood for a second, and I waited for her to head to the fridge for the sherry. But instead, she took a step back, as though losing her balance. "No, no, no," she said to no one as she began to fall back. I ran up and I caught her. "Okay, I've got you." I was angry. I shook her arms like I was trying to wake her up, but I really wanted to pummel her for all this. She didn't even look at me. She thanked me. Thanked me. "What's wrong with you?" I said. "Are you sick or what?" I mean, we all know she is. That's what the after-school specials are for. But I know it wasn't charitable of me to ask. "I think so. I think I am," she said. I really didn't think she would say it. I walked her to her room and I put her to bed. At 7, I went in to see if she wanted a chicken burger, but she didn't seem to get what I was saying. Must have woken her up. That was 6 hours ago. After dinner, I walked Jeffy over to the Canellos with our cardboard Skylab so he and Randy's brother Pete could camp out in their yard. Right now, I'm on the roof of our house. It isn't the first time. I took off my shoes so Mom wouldn't hear me because I'm sitting directly over her window. I left it open. If she needs me, I'll hear her. I guess it would be a real sight if one of our neighbors spotted a barefoot kid in a NASA helmet on the roof of our house. I lie back and listen to myself breathe and watch the satellites and stars. They blink like dogs. They wink like con men. Looking long enough at the white and blue on black, I start thinking maybe there's nothing below me but more glistening darkness and only the slenderest of tethers to my ship. As long as my senses tell me the ship is there, though, I'll maintain there's nothing for me to be afraid of. Is that funny? Miles away from anything solid, floating and thinking and fogging up my visor, confident in my ship because NASA builds these things to last. And really, all it would take is one of a million things to screw up, to explode, to cut my oxygen feed, to send me screaming into the sun. Pretty Much, Episode 64, Skylab is Falling. Written and read by Scott Clarkson. Music by Garner Firebird.